Yeah, so thank you all for coming. So I thought it would be remiss of me if I didn't take advantage of doing some advertising here. And so in case anybody doesn't know yet, the Computational Neuroscience meeting is coming to Toronto this July. And it's the first time it's actually going to be held in Canada, so it's actually pretty exciting. So just to let people know, it's in two parts. It's the 3 days of meeting and 2 days of workshop, and you could register for both or either. So you know, please check out the website and see if there's anything there that interests you. Thanks to Fields, we're also going to have what they're calling a satellite, pre-satellite workshop, as you see here, and there's the link to it. So this is going to be happening on the day before the meeting actually starts, and so I urge you to check it out. You do have to register for it, but it's free, but you do have to register. Okay. Okay. So here's the title of my talk, Designing and Discovering Cellular-Based Mechanisms Underlying Network Dynamics. And hopefully it'll become apparent to you why I chose this title. Basically, because this is a CMM, Center for Mathematical Medicine type talk, I thought I'd frame it in the framework of neurological diseases such as epilepsy, different movement disorders, and the like. And so all those, any sort of neurodegenerative neurological type diseases have to do with understanding the brain networks. And so to understand the brain networks in a pathological state, we obviously have to understand it in a normal state. And so if we want to understand it in a normal state, we can't really ignore at the outside the different cellular processes that are going on. But of course, there's different details associated with that. So if you sort of extract from there the idea of trying to think of therapeutic targets or drug design or understanding how existing drugs work, we have to think about getting a cellular-based mechanistic understanding of the network dynamics. So I wanted to start with acknowledging many people. So I want to say all present and past lab members as well as all present and past collaborators. And I put these individual names down here for this particular talk of if I used slides from their particular work. So Jenny, Jesse, Ernest, Sajia, Jorg, and Fernando I'll sort of show stuff that they've contributed to. And Liang and his lab, and Suan and her student Hojat have contributed to things that I'll be showing you here today. So this is the slide that I like to use when I sort of start things off about what we have to deal with if we want to understand the workings of the brain. And if you think of, say, any behavioral state such as epileptic seizure that invokes different systems and pathways in the brain, which itself consists of local networks of neurons, and each individual neuron has all its different complexities with its structure, and then as well there's microcircuits that synapse onto the dendritic and axonal trees for that matter. And these microcircuits themselves, the individual synapses, is complicated neurotransmission machinery, and each of these little things that you see here is a receptor or ion channel in the cell membrane, a protein, which is encoded in the genes. And the thing to take from this, which is sort of, which Fernanda put together based on many books in neuroscience, such as Gordon Shepherd's, is the bidirectionality. So there's interacting dynamics and bidirectionality. So it's sort of like, oh my gosh, if we want to understand what's going on, this is sort of mind-boggling. But at the same time, we have to sort of think about it at some level. So I put this quote here because I was just recently reading this essay that really appealed to me. I don't know this person, Deborah Gordon, but she was talking about ant colonies. But what she said in this essay that she wrote was that if we want to understand the dynamics of these different self-organizing systems, we have to focus on the details of specific systems to reveal if there are general laws. And so that very much appealed to me, and you'll see as I continue my talk. So basically, as we learn more about the specifics, in her case, ant colonies, then we'll see the analogies that are useful and ones that are maybe not so helpful. But unfortunately, life is messy and complicated. So we have rhythm. And that sort of brings me into a really nice book that has just come out last year by Buzak, who's actually giving a talk in, I guess, next month, on the rhythms of the brain. And so he encapsulates a lot of information there from Oxford Press, University Press, and says that the most interesting thing to learn about the brain is by basically how it generates these rhythmic activities, because that is sort of the potential source of cognition. But of course, in analogy to what Gordon was just saying on the previous slides, you have to worry about the details. The coupling depends on the details, and that's therein lies the challenge. So basically, neither ignore the details nor be overwhelmed by them. That's easy to say. So the outline of my talk after that little preamble is basically I'm going to give you a little background about what we're doing, and then tell you what I mean by design and discover, then tell you about three ideas because of this sort of approach, and then the future directions of where we're going or we're approaching. So there's a lot of people in here who know about the hippocampus, but for those people who don't, the hippocampus is this banana-shaped structure deep down inside the brain, the human or a rat brain here. This is the hippocampus. And if you take a slice, this is what you'd see in a rat brain in this case. So you see all the different cells and the different structure, the different layers are associated with it. Now the hippocampal cortex, hippocampus is part of the medial lobe cortex, and it's a very intensely studied region of the brain for many reasons that I've sort of itemized here. The first of that is it's very amenable to experiments. Of course, we have to be able to do experiments if we're going to sort of build these models. And it has a laminar structure, so when you slice it, as I showed you before, it retains its circuitry and all the population activities that it's known to express. It is associated with learning, memory, epileptic seizures, neurogenesis, LTP and LCD, for those who don't know, it's long-term potentiation, long-term depression. So many, many people study this part of the brain for these reasons. It also exhibits a wide range of different rhythmic activities and frequencies that are associated with various behavioral states. So there's lots of data being collected for a variety of reasons. And this slide is taken from Buzaki's 2003 paper, where he was sort of trying to show that the activities that were seen in the rat are also present in the mouse hippocampus. It is in mammalian hippocampi. So this is sticking an electrode down into the hippocampus this way, and you see the different layers, the different frequencies that are expressed. The two major ones that I'm showing here that is from their paper is the theta-gamma rhythm that is associated with movement, more awake type states. And this is theta 10 hertz, gamma 20, 40 hertz. Sharp wave, SPW is sharp wave, and ripples, which is sort of this large excursion that you see, and that is associated memory consolidation, and the ripples are sort of the higher frequency that's on top of it. So basically, you have these different rhythmic activities that are associated with different behavioral states. It's a heavily studied part of the brain, and you have interneurons. So the interneurons are these inhibitory cells, non-excitatory cells, GABAergic, non-principal cells, some people refer to it, but people tend to say interneurons a lot these days. This is a 1996 quote, but there's been many reviews and ongoing that essentially show that these inhibitory cells are, they form an extensive network that actually play a role in sort of generating these outputs by synapsing onto the pyramidal cell or excitatory cell population. They have a very divergent structure, and so that's how they do it in terms of one interneuron being able to synapse onto many, many pyramidal cells. However, they only represent 10 to 20% of the population, but because of this divergent innovation, they are able to provide the precise temporal structure that brings about these different rhythms that are seen at the EEG level. So I put these pictures here to remind myself of mentioning the heterogeneity, which is one of the complications that one has to think about, which is then harks back to the cellular-based aspect of where I'm coming from. So this, for example, is a basket cell-type interneuron in the dentate gyrus. This is a so-called OLM-type interneuron in the CA1 region, which you could kind of see a little bit here, this one in the slice preparation. Schematic is taken from developed on Klossberger's work by Moser, and what this shows is these interneurons, of which three different types are labeled here, are associated with distinct, they fire in distinct parts of oscillations or rhythmic activities that you would see. So the theta oscillations, which I mentioned before, so this is in a behaving in vivo animal, the theta oscillations associated with movement, exploration, and the like. The ripple, which is on top of the sharp waves, are during slow wave sleep and rest, and you see that the red is when they preferentially fire over the as opposed to the blue, and you see the basket cells, the axonic cells, and OLM cells actually fire in very distinct regions for these different patterns. So this indicates that there are distinct aspects associated with these different cells, or suggests that. If people have questions while I'm talking, please pipe in. Yes. Like all the graphs, like so. This is. Yes. So this. So let me just go back to. Okay. So this is like extra. Yep. Yes. Sorry, I should have said that. So these are like extracellular recording. This is voltage versus time. Yeah. And then so this one is actually just a schematic, and so this is illustrating by the color the where this particular cell fires preferentially during this theta oscillation, which is measured extracellular EEG. So basically, they did, they called it, I think, loose patch type recordings in vivo so that they could identify the different type of interneurons that were firing during this particular behavior. And during this behavior, these kind of oscillations occur. So this is a schematic representation. Okay, so now jumping to a very nice review that just came out 2 months ago in Nature Reviews Neuroscience, to sort of, first of all, extract this nice picture, which was from the earlier paper, showing two basket cells, which are these one type of interneuron that actually have mutual connection. So as I mentioned, there's many different types, but these particular types are known to interconnect. So there's mutual inhibitory networks of basket cells, and many network models have been produced and show that you can get coherence at these high frequencies. So what I also wanted to say is these basket cells that are shown here are the ones that form these interconnected networks, and they are known to synapse close to the cell body of the exciter cell population. So recall I was talking about them setting the temporal structure. So if you're firing closer to the cell body, putting synapses there, you maybe perhaps have a different effect than this kind of interneuron, which is known to synapse on distal regions, so it takes some time before it gets up to the cell body. So again, this kind of information is known because there's tons and tons of experimental works being done, but there's details and differences and stuff, and so that's part of the challenge. So I mentioned this because this is from a modeling perspective where a lot of focus has happened, because we know quite a bit about basket cells in terms of their firing patterns, say, and also that they are associated with the gamma rhythms, these fast frequencies. So network models of them are able to produce coherence, that is synchronous firing, I'm using these words a little loosely, at these higher gamma frequencies. So a lot of modeling has happened in that realm. But I want to step back a decade, or 15 years actually for that matter, to mention this work, because to me this was this theoretical insight, or this seminal, well, this paper, I guess, is what sort of drove a lot of the work in the inhibitory network. At least it has for me, and it has for many others. But in terms of the timing of when things came out and how people have used this work to understand what's going on, so this is a couple of papers by Wang and Rinzel that came out in 1992. Basically, in that paper, they have a two-cell network of a mutual inhibitory network of two cells, inhibitory cells. And what they showed in that paper, among other things, using K-splain analysis, that you can get synchronized outputs. In other words, these two cells would fire synchronously, coherently. Again, I'm using it loosely. If your postsynaptic conductance decayed sufficiently slowly. So that is the synapse, the kinetics associated with that synapse were such that these cells would both feel some average inhibition, so you can imagine that they'd fire at the same time. So that was back in 1992. And at the time, they were actually modeling or thinking about thalamic cells and looking at synchronous output there. So what was in this individual cell was a T-type calcium current and all the differences. But this idea has since been taken forward to hippocampus by Wang and Buzaki. And in vivo studies have showed about the mutual inhibitory networks and the basket cells, and all those sort of experimental details have sort of fill things in. I mention this because that will come into sort of design discover idea. To go back to this slide, to say that that fundamental idea was taken in these sort of larger network models that, or simulation type models, that sort of analysis idea, to understand how you can get the coherent output out of the larger networks. Okay, but it's not as if we understand what's really going on completely, because in the same review, there was a really nice figure one, that they had to show, well, okay, you have these theta gamma, these higher frequency oscillations that occur during movement, cognitive type processing state, but there are many different preparations, and this is in vitro preparation. So in vivo, you have these oscillations of that frequency, but in vitro, you have gamma oscillations that can be produced in many different ways. So this sort of illustrates the sort of two differences, if you like, and I'm just going to sort of focus here because the take-home message is really that the context, you just can't ignore the context if we're going to try and really understand and put these sort of things, come up with cellular-based mechanistic understandings of network dynamics, is the blue represents inhibition. So as you go to the right, that means the inhibitory effect is more strong in producing these faster rhythms. So this represents a little mutual inhibitory network representation, giving its inhibition onto the pyramidal excitatory population. So therefore, the mechanism by which you get the synchronous output at the higher frequency is based on the inhibitory network. And this is what was seen in vitro preparation. So this is showing an electrical recording in the control situation. And now when you put on So there's different ways to induce it, and here they're showing with kinate, you get these higher frequency oscillations. You can also do it with metabotropic receptors, receptor agonists. But if you block with this drug the excitatory input, you don't lose it. But if you block the inhibitory input with bifuculin, you lose it. So this is showing that it's this kind of mechanism as distinct from other ones that involve carbachol, which I wouldn't talk about, because the point here is that the context of how you look at it is key. And so, yes, it could be an intrinsic oscillator, but there is afferent input coming in. I mean, this is just drawn very simply. Certainly the sort of input that, where there's sort of the surrounding extracellular milieu, but there's definitely excitatory input. I'm highly simplifying this. They come from different regions, or they highly simplified it. Yeah. Not necessarily bursting. This assumes that this is too simple to sort of to say. So, for example, the fact that these cells fire mean they have to have some kind of input, potentially. You know, there has to be some balance that allows them to fire and produce oscillations, which are not showing here. The idea is really that the mechanism underlying the coherence of these fast gamma oscillation is due to this inhibitory network driving the parameter cell population, as opposed to here where the feedback from the excitatory population is key mechanistically to produce the oscillation. And so they were able to tease this apart experimentally by applying the different drugs under different circumstances. But the point is that the sort of take-home message, if you like, is in these models of basket cell or inhibitory networks assume this kind of context, as opposed to this kind of context. Like, it's not going to be able to capture this one because it's not considering it, those models that have done that. Yep?
Yeah, I mean, this takes us back to Silverstein's work way back, where they were in the ganglion,
stomatic acid ganglion, yeah.
Where the implication was that for this mutually inhibitory type of cell,
LPPD,
they need a tonic excitatory input. Otherwise, nothing would happen. They already introduced that.
Right. Yeah. So what, and I'll actually talk about this a little bit, because what becomes difficult about this matter is, like, what is this excitatory input? How is it brought about biologically? So how do you represent it appropriately in your models? And so it's, you know, I'm going to show you some equations, I'll sort of talk about that a bit more. But this is sort of just a simplification about really getting at the essence of the mechanism that's producing the coherent oscillations. And this is based on experimental work. Yep. So then what all I really want to say at this point about the design and discover, which I'm using in the title and the quotations are very intentional, is because there's all these levels of complexity and how we're supposed to tackle it and really get a cellular-based understanding. And so over time and looking at different things, I sort of think that maybe this is an approach that makes sense of, you know, that we could make progress on, which is to invoke some underlying mechanism of how the network produces its, you know, particular output. And by necessity, smaller networks would have to be used because one wants to keep a cellular perspective. That is, put whatever ion channels and all the rest that are associated based on experimental work. But the first of all, invoke some underlying mechanism. You have to use ideas and insight from both experiment and theory, because you have to think, well, what is it that's important in the experiment to have the rationale? But you very much need the theory, because, you know, this is a nonlinear system of equations, and in terms of what's going to come out, how can you predict? You need the theory to sort of be able to give us insight in how the mechanism is going to play out and produce the output that you hope to achieve, so that then also you could take advantage of the mathematical analysis. Then build a larger network using that understanding from the smaller networks, and then, of course, you have to bring in additional experimental constraints. And then the discover in quotes is to say that if now your resulting network output compares favorably with, you know, whatever manipulations you're doing experimentally, and there is important to put into your model what is possible to manipulate experimentally, then one could say that the invoked mechanism maybe is biologically plausible and to go on to make additional predictions. So that's it in a nutshell of what I'm suggesting. And then the take-home message would be, then you'd have a design discovery of the workings of biological network in a particular context, because, again, context, because of all the different things that have to be considered. Okay, so now what I'm going to do is just tell you sort of three ideas that sort of, you know, speak to this whole design and discover approach of going about things. And the first idea is to use heterogeneity to compare single compartment neuronal models. So I'm showing this nice picture to remind myself that, okay, well, it's single compartment, but you know, there's a lot more detail involved. But this is an example where, for example, if basket cells, which are known, as I mentioned, to synapse on the perisomatic region, so near the cell body, so that's where they get the inhibitory synapses. You can approximate it with a single compartment. There's a rationale to do that, and that is maybe reasonable given that you're thinking of these fast oscillations. So these, this is where I'm going to remind myself, actually remind myself of several things. One, I have the giant squid up here to remind myself to say that it's because of Hodgkin Huxley's work on the squid giant axon that we have these models to work with in the first place. So they did beautiful recordings in the giant axon, and that's how they came up with this sort of equivalent circuit representation, this conductance-based model that's heavily used in all of in computational neuroscience today, or in, I should say neuroscience today. And so you can see very there, this is the capacitance, the voltage change. This is a sodium channel, just giving an ohmic representation in a nutshell, sodium, potassium, and a leak current. And this I applied is the one, the parameter that is representing this afferent input coming to the system. And this is where the heterogeneity will be introduced, to sort of, which is a very reasonable and the most sensible thing to put it, where to put it in the first place, because by definition, you're never going to have this homogeneous system of cells to put it in there. And by the way, this has been thought about by many others. We're building on people's work. So this is Wang and Buzaki's model that was developed to represent a basket cell, this hippocampal interneural cell, of which you see a picture from dentate gyrus there. So you see the eye applied current, which is sort of this injected current representing afferent input. It has a sodium transient current representation, a potassium, and a leak. The H and the N are the kinetic variables representing the inactivation of the sodium channel, and N the activation of the potassium channel. So this is this form of the model, as I mentioned, is derived from the squid giant axon, well, Hodgkin-Huxley and CAPS also. And then making a small network, these two cell networks, by putting in variability in the drive by this epsilon, so just making the difference two epsilons. Then one could define a percent heterogeneity as a difference in the intrinsic frequency firing at the different cells of those two different injected current levels. And then in this case, we're just talking about a first order kinetic representation for the inhibitory synapse. This will be the maximal conductance, and this is the first order kinetic process. There's other details here, but the I just sort of want to give people the gist of it. So again, if there's something essential, just stop that people want to explain more, please don't hesitate to stop me. So sure. Yes, this is just a two cell network at this stage. Yeah. Yes, ordinary. Yes. Yes. There's the. Yeah. So there's a big assumption being made here that if, in terms of investigating these gamma fast oscillations, the key, the essential point is the essential contributor, if you like, to this rhythm is these gamma. This is these basket cells that fire near. Well, near to the somatic region, so there's not a significant spatial contribution. I could tell you now, though, that if one is considering other circumstances, they actually now know that these dendrites have active properties, so we actually can't ignore them, and there's electrical gap junctions out in the dendritic. So, for sure, but this is sort of exactly the sort of context and all the rest of it of how to sort of really approach it, because otherwise, on day one, you're stuck, kind of. You know, at least I would be stuck, maybe not somebody else. Okay, so then Jenny did many simulations here, and I'm showing you example also from this two-cell network, heterogeneous two-cell network, and this sort of, Nancy Kopel's group has done this looking at mild heterogeneity, so, but the emphasis here was more to look at expanding how much heterogeneity can this network withstand, and so from this was born this idea that I mentioned in the beginning about being able to compare, so this is just showing that you have near sync different patterns, not surprising if it's nonlinear system, and I wanted to jump to sort of the bifurcation diagrams that Suen and Hojat did in this heterogeneous system. Probably most people are somewhat familiar. So basically, if you look at the bifurcation parameter, in this case, is the mean injected current, because now we have this heterogeneity epsilon associated with it. And what's really nice about the analysis, the bifurcation numerical continuation, is you could see very easily what range of parameters give you multi-stability. So in this case, you see suppression stable together with near synchronous in this parameter range of I mu, and then of course there's other parameters in the system, which is something very difficult, if not impossible, to get out of simulations. But of course it's difficult to set these up often in this two-cell system. This is now showing epsilon as your bifurcation parameter, and you see multistability in the near synchronous and near antiphase state that I'm sort of illustrating here. For again, these are chosen parameter sets, of course. This is now showing tau sin, the decay time constant associated with the inhibitory synapse, and you don't have multistability, but it very clearly shows you at what values of decay time constant you get suppression, which is this behavior versus near synchronous activity. So you know, you can do these studies and sort of understand, as I was talking about in the beginning, the analysis of what's happening in your smaller networks for your choice of cellular model. Yes, I have no please do. Oh, that's unstable. This is numerical continuation. Yeah. I mean, we did simulations and analysis, if I'm understanding you correctly. So, I mean, the output that you show before, the voltage versus time, so those are all simulations. And then if you take the model, so that would be an eighth order system model, and then this is you have to use numerical techniques to do the analysis because you have this large system of equations. So this is the bifurcation analysis in XPPAUT, and then you do the continuation. This is a bifurcation point, half bifurcation here, where you get oscillations that emanate after having stable steady state here, and then you have to follow different branches and just get the different patterns out. So it is, right. Yes. Sorry. Yes. And I probably glossed over it, but yeah, so this is to represent the stable one. So these thick, solid lines are the ones we would see in just the simulations of the set of differential equations. So I just wanted to differentiate between the simulations and analyses in that way, even though they're both numerical. Yep.
So then, can you give us again this concept of the bottom line being in no man's land, right? This is the old idea there that, you know, we hypothesize, but you cannot numerically actually find it.
Right. You would never stay unless you were. Yeah. You wouldn't find it. Yeah, you wouldn't find it just from simulations. Okay. Yep. So I guess what I'm trying to bring about by mentioning the Wang and Rinzel earlier work is sort of the. Well, in that case, they did phase plane analysis, but any sort of these mathematical analyses have to be combined for to sort of get a handle on what's going on. That's basically going to be the essence. But this is the idea. So we can do these bifurcation numerical continuations on a set of this model, this two-cell network in this case. And what we did here was, so if we look at I mu, which is the mean injected current value, what you could do is keep changing that epsilon parameter, which represents the heterogeneity, and see how large it could get. So this is in percent heterogeneity before you lose the ability to have spike-to-spike synchrony, that synchronous output, and use that as a measure of an optimal parameter set. Why do I want to do that? Well, because there's no end to detail that you could put into your individual intrinsic cell model. There I showed you Wang and Buzaki's model, which had sodium and potassium, delayed rectifier potassium, but it's about, you know, six different types of potassium channels, persistent type sodium. There's maybe 15 different types of channels which are known to exist in these cells. So details are going to affect the output you have, but the question is it a significant detail in the context that you're looking at? And here I'm referring to the sort of context of spike-to-spike synchrony that is assumed to underline these gamma rhythms with the basket cell network. So the idea here is to just have a way to quantitatively evaluate the importance of these different intrinsic properties. So because we got this non-Mortonic relationship from the analyses, I think it is possible. Well, you certainly can do that. So this is with this IMU parameter, but with the tau sin, the delayed rectifier, you also see that it's around actually 5 milliseconds where you have this sort of 12% heterogeneity that's possible for the network to withstand, two-cell network to withstand. So that's the first idea, if you like. And I don't mind people interrupting me, but okay. So then the second idea, the third one is much faster because it's very preliminary still. So the second idea is to use these two-cell model outputs to actually constrain and predict the larger networks. So this is, I'm actually very excited about this because first I wasn't sure if it made sense what we were trying to do, and finally people said, well, okay, yeah, so, and for what we got. So the idea here is we have these two-cell simulations, we have these different analyses, we understand sort of what's going on in that sense. If we now build a larger network, and in this case, I simply mean 20, 50, 100, but you can go on, and I think it's, for this result that I'm presenting, it's pretty clear. In this case, it's also a coupled inhibitory network that I'm talking about, but then we distribute the heterogeneity up to a maximal amount, and we know from the two-cell networks what sort of patterns can be expressed. You know, there's multi-stability, there's synchronous, and all the rest of it distributed there, and then you have different initial conditions that you're doing in the simulations. Here, I'm just talking about pure simulations. Does the two-cell network results tell us anything about what we would get in the larger cell network? That's basically what we're looking for, and the answer is yes, otherwise I wouldn't be telling you this. So this is, I'm just showing you some example from a set of parameters. From the two-cell situation, we know that we got near-synchronous solutions, but no multi-stability for this set of parameters, and this is just a 20-1500 cell network, and you see that there's a clear map in between the near-synchronous solutions and what you see as coherent patterns. This is a raster plot that I'm showing here, so just where the spikes would fire over time in the 100-cell network, so each one of these is a cell firing, so you see a very clearly coherent output. This example is where the parameters were chosen from the two-cell network such that you had bistability. So there was bistability between near-synchronous and near-antiphase, and in the larger cell networks for the many, many sets of simulations that were done, you see clear patterns or coherence emerging that represent the near-synchronous and the near-antiphase. So these frequencies in the coherent regions, if you like, are the same as you'd see in the two-cell system. And then another example here, bistability between the near-synchronous and the suppressed solutions. This one I like to show, even though it's maybe a little artificial, because the idea here is in terms of these large networks actually representing something in the biological system, the initial conditions, of course, represent the state of the whatever network you're looking at that point in time. And so now if I set up two sets of initial conditions, of depolarized and hyperpolarized, if you like, from the synaptic situation, for these set of parameters that I looked at, you see that the depolarized conditions always give you near-synchronous coherent output mapped up to the large network, whereas the hyperpolarized give you the near-antiphase type behavior. So it was surprising how precise this quantification from the two-cell network could be, because, again, I mean, there's no reason that this necessarily should have worked. Yes. And you could see that with the suppression too here, that there's less of them there because some of them are just not firing. So the second idea is that, so I think it's fair to say that quantitative linkages can occur between the two-cell network. This is not to say that that's the only thing you'll see, because in the large network situations, you'll have more patterns that would emerge for sure. But this, for example, is one of the bistable patterns in the two-cell network. So for the same set of parameters, you have both spike-to-spike type synchrony and antiphase. And in a couple of the example runs that I've seen, you can get the patterns that resemble this one or patterns that resemble this one. You can see, and the frequencies actually match. So that you get basically distinct coherent patterns as a result of the multi-stability that's present in the two-cell system. Yeah. I'm using identical parameters in the two-cell model as I do in the N-cell, and I'm normalizing for sure the synaptic connections, otherwise you're in a different, you know, dynamical regime. So for example, the two-cell system, if your G-sin is 0.2 millisiemens per square centimeter, in the 50-cell system, to make sure the maximum amount of any cell, that it's normalized by the number, but besides that,
right?
Yeah, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but the cellular properties aren't changed, or the time constant, anything. It's just asking because that's the function of the larger network. Yeah, for sure. Okay, so that's the second idea in terms of this design and discover approach. And then finally, the third idea, which is a lot faster, which is basically we want to kind of get to the experimental data in the network sense. And so to estimate the synaptic parameters I have here from axon virtual model networks, and I say it like that because what is possible to do because of a VMD method that was developed by Rudolph and colleagues is estimate the synaptic conductance from the experimental recordings, and these will just be current clamp step recordings, so you're just measuring the voltage over time, so these fluctuations in this way. The way they did it is, so here's the two recordings. You require at least two recordings at different injected current values. You remove the spikes. So this is like current clamp recordings. You remove the spikes and then build up these distributions from these voltage recordings. Get the mean and the standard deviation from these distributions of the experimental data. And then because of the assumption of the representation of the cell from which these recordings come from, which is a passive cell with excitatory inhibitory noisy currents in the background, they inverted the equation that represents that to get an estimate of the synaptic noise. So you're plugging it in a set of equations because of the ability to do that using these values. So basically you get estimations of excitatory inhibitory means and conductances from the experimental data. Now, suffice it to say there's various caveats and issues and assumptions and stuff going to this that Ernest is actually dealing with this directly with the experimental data, but he has a lot of ideas on overcoming certain caveats. But as you see back there, one of the things you have to do is remove the spikes. Okay. So now if we go back to our model networks, those 50-cell, 100-cell different networks in which you're sort of trying to develop a mechanistic understanding of what's going on, the idea here is that if we have spike-free data from our network models, so our deterministic network models, and I'm assuming, that's a big one, that the variable patterning can be captured by averaging across many deterministic simulations in which you have different initial conditions and heterogeneity. So what I'm plotting up here is the total synaptic current averaged over, in this case, 200 sets of simulations for three different sets of parameters. And the question here is, can you differentiate, is there a difference that one would see in extracting the synaptic conductances from those models when you remove the spikes for the different parameter sets? So let me say that in a less confusing way, because I'm not showing everything here. So this is just showing for a given cell in a 50-cell network, if you do, in this case, 200 simulations, different initial conditions, different randomly distributed heterogeneity up to that maximum amount in the same way I discussed before, what sort of average synaptic current does that cell feel? And this is sort of assumption representing, say that in the noisy network of an individual cell, that could capture the essence of what's going on there. I have no proof to say that's the case. I'm an assumption I'm making. But if we now take those networks and all those different deterministic simulations, remove the spikes, as you would have to do in the method in experimental data, and then extract the synaptic conductances, build up a distribution, and then get the mean and the standard deviation of those synaptic conductances from the model, do we see changes between the different cases, which are just different parameter sets that correspond with what it actually is? So, I mean, it's not nothing too complicated that I'm doing there, but this is just sort of saying that because we want to do the same thing, because we want to bring the model and the experimental networks together is what we're after in the larger networks. So this is just showing two examples. Again, this is a total average current for two different situations, and this is just an illustration that your inhibitory conductance, which is smaller here relative to here, is true when you extract those means as I talked about. This is now a representation for a biological cell, if you like, that Ernest did with just simply changing the in this case, the excitatory conductance is larger. He knows this in the model, but this would be as a pre-step to deal with the experimental data, which he is right now. And so when you remove the spikes and apply the VMD and all the rest of it I talked about, do you get appropriate balances in the conductance? The answer is yes. I'm sort of illustrating it here. So the idea is to make that link or get the constraints from the experimental data of these balances once you scale it up. Okay, so I'm almost done. So basically, just review the three ideas that I presented and sort of hopefully I gave you the motivation rationale for why we're trying to do that. The first idea is to really be able to have some kind of quantitative evaluation of cellular details. We have to care about the cellular details. We don't want to worry about every single cellular detail, but we have to have some kind of way to think about when it is or not important. And so the idea presented basically derived from those bifurcation numerical continuation studies that we did. And so that's what I'm proposing that way. And there's more to it, but if you read our paper, you'll see it. But that in turn predicts what sort of network frequencies come out, but that's an additional issue. The second idea is these two-to-N cell network linkages, which I'm very excited about because it sort of gives us a way to really be able to take advantage of what we can do with the mathematical analysis of the smaller networks and worrying about the cellular details and take it up. So when you're dealing with the large network simulations, you're not doing it completely blindly. You have some kind of constraints or understanding that derives from the smaller networks and analyses. And then finally, to sort of bring in the constraints from the larger networks, you need to be able to link back to the experimental data. And so that's what I'm talking about here with the model experimental links. Again, that's very much work in progress, the last one. So to onward. So I was talking about all this stuff in the context of spike synchrony for gamma rhythms, the faster ones, because that's where a lot of the work has been done with the basket cells, because you have this mutual inhibition and all the like. But all of that is because I'm very much motivated by these recordings. These are extracellular recordings that are from Liang Zhang's lab, and they're spontaneous rhythmic field potentials that have a very interesting developmental profile. But what you're seeing here is this robust oscillation, extracellular, that population activity that is an inhibitory-based rhythm. So this happens because of coherent activity between the different inhibitory cell populations. Now, there's more details and stuff associated with it, which I won't talk about right now, but this is now showing time frequency analysis that Jesse has done on these rhythms because it's a pretty complex signal. And I haven't talked about Jesse's work specifically, but in order to sort of get constraints on the models, we want to get as much as we can from the analysis and the signal itself. And so that's another set of work that's happening. Yep. Mm-hmm. This is about a three-quick rhythm. It's a slow rhythm, too. I forgot to say that. Yeah.
Is it the same time scale for both the up and the lower
train? Yes. Yeah, 50 micro. Actually, I wasn't trying to make that point. I was just showing it's sort of stable. So here you see it has stabilized, and it lasts for a long time. Right, so there's definitely a trend. Well, this is a whole other conversation, but this is exactly how Jesse's work ended up starting, because depending on what choice of experimental set you take and how you choose to measure the frequency, point-to-point or whatever, it could be different, right? So you need some sort of unbiased way to characterize the experimental data, and that's basically this paper of Jesse's does that precisely. So there is definitely transient, that's why he's using time frequency analysis together with object identification. And well, to be able to talk about limit cycles, you have to have a model, you have a nonlinear system you're talking about. So then you're back to what it is. So let me continue. So getting back to this whole design and discover idea, which is what I would like to think about in terms of Liang's SRFP. So this work by Sajian Yorg, two-cell inhibitory network system, but now there's the added complexity of short-term plasticity in the synapses and synaptic depression, which is understood in a mapping sense of how you get this alternating burst and pattern as well as an emergent synchrony pattern out from a dynamical system, like dynamical point of view. Why this is interesting is because if you look at the synchronous pattern, the frequency of that, it's a slower frequency, which actually happens to be bistable with the synchronous fast oscillation, which is very interesting because those SRFPs can become gamma oscillations in a developmental profile, but that's a separate matter. So the idea is here's a mechanism that we'd like to invoke to that may be underlying the population activities and sort of take it up in the way, the approach that I talked about. So I'm just about done, slide, to say, well, you know, to just trying to give you a gist of what we're doing and where we're going. Really, we'd like to sort of have an understanding of inhibitory networks and rhythmic brain dynamics, because really the inhibitory cells are what, in my view, is the most exciting, because they actually seem to be the controllers of the rhythms. It's not to say that excitatory cells are not important, but in terms of getting at the essence of how these rhythms are produced mechanistically. And this that Fernanda put together is now just a more specific cycle of the different levels of complexity that one can't ignore, but you need to rationalize different parts of it as you approach the problem. So, and this is to remind me to say that besides all the funding that one needs to do this, this is very much collaborative work. I mean, like, in order for us to sort of do this, we need everybody to work together from all the different disciplines. And so that to me is the key aspect. And to go back to Gordon's quote in the beginning about trying to get a general understanding, so trying to worry about the specifics in the first place, so that maybe we could get some sort of general understanding, and that's it.